Digging isn't so early.
6:23.
Okay.
Start.
Okay, so we'll just read a few interesting Rashis about the actual Yetzias Mitzrayim. So much as the build-up, the makos, the instructions, what should be done, but what actually happened. So, first of all, the Torah is very deliberate about the dating. We'll find the pasuk here. Vayihi miketz shloshim shana ve'arba me'ah shana vayihi be'etzem hayom hazeh Yatzu kol tzivos Hashem meiritz mitzayim. So Parak Yud Beis, Pasuk Mem Aleph. The Torah is very clear. Be'etzem hayom hazeh. So the word miketz is very deliberate. Miketz shloshim shana ve'arba me'ah shana. Of course, the dating scheme has to be adjusted. And Rashi adjusts the dating scheme. It's not 430 years since the descent of Mitzrayim, but 430 years since the birth of Yitzchak. But miketz ve'be'etzem hayom hazeh. It seems like a redundant pasuk. In terms of the actual narrative, there's something larger that's being discussed. So Rashi quotes the Michilta. Magid, Mikivan Shigia Haketz, Vahim Miketz, as soon as that time arrived, Lo Ikon HaMakom Karefai, Hashem didn't tarry or delay even a split second. Okay, so there's a certain degree of haste and lack of delay because they're suffering. But the end of Rashi isn't just that Hashem didn't delay, but the word Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh means that it was a special day. Tesvav Nisan Bo Malachi Asharis Eitzel Afram. This was the day that the beginning of Vayera occurred, or Tesvav Nisan, Pesach. Tesvav Nisan Nala Yitzchak. Yitzchak was born a year later, right? Keis Chaya, Parshas Vayera. Tesvav Nisan Nigzra Gezeres Bein Absar. That we didn't really know until this Rashi. That it wasn't just the day of the visit of the Malachim or the day of Yitzchak's birth, it was also the day of Bris Bein Absar, which was undated, maybe intentionally, in Parshas Lech Lecha. So why is the Torah stressing this according to Rashi? What do we care that it's the same day? Be'etzem hayom hazeh, miketz. So I think there are two issues. One is hashgacha pratis, theologically. Kadosh Baruch Hu, history isn't random. Events happen based on very, very precise, not just general supervision and decisions and governance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but very, very precise. So Hashem has these four major events, Bris Bein Abisarim, the visitation of the angels, Yitzchak's birth, and Yetzias Mitzrayim all happening on Pesach. In fact, Pesach was Pesach. Before Yetzias Mitzrayim, Pesach was an important day. This was the day that people spoke about. Oh, remember Zaidi had a visit from the Malachim? Remember Zaidi was born? Remember Zaidi told us that he had an encounter with the Kodesh Baruch Hu on the mountain? So Pesach was an important day, even before Yetzias Mitzrayim. But not just theologically, from a Kodesh Baruch Hu standpoint, that we can be confident that Hashem governs this world with a very, very precise supervision, but also from our perspective, when events occur on the same day, we're reminded of the cyclical nature of history. Take a look at, let's say, Aseret B'Teves. Are any of the events that happened on Aseret B'Teves per se so tragic and so traumatic? We just commemorated a month ago. Translation of the Torah, but the same thing with Shavuot B'Tammuz. It's not like Tisha B'Av, which basically was destroyed, but once you had three or four events happening on the same day, Chazal sense that this was a day that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had selected for warnings, for signals, for wake-up calls. It was the overlapping of certain events that happened on these days. So the same thing here. The overlap reminds us that in general, history isn't open-ended. History, Judaism believes that history isn't progressive. History isn't evolutionary. It's cyclical. It turns back to its terminus. It's not open-ended. And part of the cyclical nature of history is that we're returning to the same patterns of history, or whatever happened in the past will happen again in the future. And it's borne out by the fact that not just are the patterns and the locations the same, but even the dates are the same. So when you have historical events recurring on the same date, it's not just that from Hashem's perspective we know that he's Mashgiach Meda Achavanos and HaKadosh Baruch Hu has Hashgacha Pratis, but we have the sense of how to view history and how to learn from history. Everyone wants to learn from history, but you want to learn from history general patterns. Jews learn from history specific locations, specific patterns. We look at Tanakh, we look at history, we realize we'll return to the same locations. The same lifestyle, the same date, the same. So this Be'etzem Hayom Hazeh at the launch of history is reminding us that events overlap on the same day, and that reminds us that it's not just an overlapping dating scheme, but it's also overlapping patterns and overlapping places and overlapping conclusions. So it's important for Rashi to stress that as Am Yisrael is leaving Mitzrayim, this is a day in which four different events occur. Okay. While they're leaving, it discusses how quickly they have to leave, and the icon that captures how rapidly they left is in matzah. They only had a few seconds to leave because everything was so rushed and hurried, so they can only bake it into matzah. Kilochametz, they couldn't have time to rise. They were evicted from Egypt. They couldn't delay. They were being pushed out of Egypt. There's a line of chipazon. And then the pasuk adds, by the way, not only could they not bake the bread, but vagam seda lo sulam. They couldn't take any other food. It seems like an additive. Vagam seda lo sulam. What are we adding by the fact they didn't take any extra food? So to amplify this, Rashi quotes the Mechilta. Lehagid magid shivchon shel Yisrael. This actually demonstrates how euphoric and how engaged Am Yisrael was in this geula process with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The fact that they couldn't bake the matzah, that wasn't their decision. They wanted to bake the matzah, they just were pulled out too quickly. The Egyptians were hurrying them out. But they did make a decision, consciously, not to take extra food. They had some food lying around, they had some seidat. The bread that they were baking couldn't be baked into chametz, but they had some scraps, they had some food, they had some other opportunities just to grab some food. They were taking gold and silver and clothing from the Egyptians, they could have taken some food. That was their decision. Not to take bread wasn't their decision. That was just the exigencies of this moment. Not to take food, that was their decision because they trusted Hashem. She lo amru, they didn't tell themselves, how can we enter this desert without any food? Elohiminu, they trusted Hashem. V'halchu, hushim meforsh ba-kabbalah. Very interesting Rashi. Rashi calls Tanakh Kabbalah. This is the only time, as far as I know, that Rashi calls Tanakh Divrei Kabbalah. It's the Gemara in Pesachim, Divrei Torah, Divrei Kabbalah le'yofinan. Why is Tanakh called Kabbalah? Rashi in Maseches Pesachim says because the purpose of a Navi is to complain, is to try to challenge us, to be kovel, is to try to challenge us morally. We think it's called Divrei Kabbalah. What do you mean? It's Zohar, it's Shem Bayochai, it's Navi. It's the most easy book to read. Divrei Kabbalah means because the Nevi'im's job was to be kovel, was to complain, was to be a whistleblower morally. So Rashi quotes a pasuk in Yirmiyah, the very famous pasuk, Zecharti lachesin urayach, avas kilosayach, lechtech achray bamidbar be'eretz lo zrua. But if you just read that pasuk in Yirmiyah, we didn't do anything special. We were pushed out. The Jews were hurrying us out. The Baruch was drawing us quickly. And the matzah is the greatest symbol that we didn't initiate anything special or romantic. So that's why Rashi tags the pasuk in Yirmiyah to these last three phrases in Parshas Bo. Vagam seda lo asu lahem, that part is the romance. That part is the faith. The fact that they only baked their matzah because they were rushed out. The fact they didn't take food was their personal, voluntary decision that they trusted HaKadosh Baruch Hu so deeply. And I think what it shows us about relationships is that sometimes even small gestures matter. If you look at it through the lenses of Yirmiyah, you think as if we made these major romantic declarations, we're following you into the desert, we don't care, we're divorcing ourselves of any ammunition or any resources. That's not what happened. What happened was they were hurried out. They wanted to bake the bread, they couldn't, because they didn't have time. There was just one small gesture that showed that they loved and trusted HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the fact they didn't take any extra bread. And that gesture becomes the basis of this big romantic description in Yirmiyah. Sometimes when you have relationships, we underestimate the value of small details and small gestures. People aren't interested in the actual present on their birthday. They want to know that you care about it and you remember their birthday. They're not interested in how much time you spend. Rather, that you care to spend time, you take time out of your day and your schedule, that you're aware, that you're mindful. And this is a template for our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which just serves to remind us about how we build relationships. And sometimes, I don't have enough time, so therefore I won't even spend those 2 extra minutes. Sometimes these small gestures are more impactful than larger deliveries without the thought and without, you know, the thought that counts. And so here really is the thought that counts. The entire scene was frantic and panic-struck and everyone's bustling around trying to get out and the bread didn't break. And yet, in say for Yirmiyah, this is a great love affair that we trusted Hashem. There's no trust on display through the matzah. There's trust on display with the fact that we didn't take a couple granola bars or a couple Cliff bars or a couple extra nuts or something just to have some food for the road. So that's the second Rashi. The third Rashi is what they took and how they took it. So they took klei kesef u klei zav u smalos. Now, if you look carefully in the middle of Parshas Bo, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu issues the command to Moshe, he doesn't mention clothing. He mentions they should take, like Yosef Echlezov, but evidently the Jews took clothing. Not only did they take clothing, but clothing is mentioned towards the end of the Pasuk. And Rashi notes this, Usmalot af hein hayu chashuvas le min hakesef min hazav. The clothing was more important than the kesef and the zav. The mu'uchar b'pasuk chashuv. And the last item in this iteration is the most important item. Achron chaviv, chashuv. Why would clothing be more important than gold and silver? You can buy a lot of clothing with gold and silver. Sometimes when, you know, I've got some females in the family, when they tell me they spent this much on the dress or this much on the pocketbook, I say, I hope it came, unless the dress costs 400 shekels, I hope it came with 300 shekels in the pocket. Especially for boys, we don't really value clothing as deeply as some others, but even if you value clothing, you can buy a lot of nice clothing. If you told me I had a shopping cart to go through Egypt and fill the shopping cart, but I can only take one shopping cart through my neighbor's home, I would fill it with gold and silver and then scurry it away, and then I could buy as many clothing. It would be a waste to fill it with clothing, especially if it's bulky clothing like a winter coat. How much gold could I fit into the volume occupied by a winter coat? So I think there's a couple items on display. Number one, remember, slaves in ancient Egypt had to walk around naked their entire lives in ancient Egypt. It's very humiliating, it's very debasing, it's very dehumanizing. So this was the first time, or at least, maybe some of that's persecution abated during the Makos, but they valued their dignity. Part of the thing of what is on display is, remember, I'm thinking about Chazal's very famous Medrash, that in Mitzrayim the Jews lost all of their religious ideology, and they fell into the world of Avodah Zarah. But the three cultural markers that they maintained were their language, their names, and their dress, Shaloshinu, which is an important issue about Jewish culture. Sometimes we take Jewish culture for granted, that today there are some Jews who unfortunately have wandered religiously, and we call them cultural Jews. They like Jewish food, they like Jewish holidays, they like Jewish writers, Jewish authors, Jewish culture, Jewish art. And we tend to trivialize them, and certainly we're sad that they don't have more of a religion-based identity. But in Egypt, the cultural preservation served as a platform for national recovery and national restoration. They really lost everything religiously, but the fact that they were still cultural Jews meant there was a platform on which their Judaism could then begin to flower and blossom. So for all those 210 years while they were under siege, they couldn't wear Egyptian clothing because they were worried about their identity. They were worried about their Jewish identity. But now that they were being redeemed and they had a sense of their Jewish identity, then they could afford to wear Egyptian clothing, which probably were nicer. This says a lot about the difference of life in Chutz La'aretz and life in Eretz Yisrael, for better or for worse. I think a lot of Jews in Chutz La'aretz live deep down with a sense of a siege mentality. We have to do everything possible to protect our Jewish identity, because if we let up and if we compromise, maybe Jewish identity will become eroded. Which I think people in Eretz Yisrael feel like, I have an inborn innate Jewish identity. I live in the state of Israel. I serve in the army. I'm a Jew. I live with Jews, for better or for worse. I think sometimes people are a little bit too lax sometimes with religious commitment here, because after all, I'm a Jew. And I think sometimes in Chutz La'aretz, religious commitment is very, very intense and punctilious, because there's a fear of abdicating complete Jewish identity. But at least there's a sense that, without getting into the Kabbalistic notions of what Egyptian clothing were, Rav Amital spoke a lot that these were not just clothing, but taking the sparks and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's essence and the wisdom of Egypt and trying to integrate it and incorporate it within Judaism and within the flow of human experience which Judaism was advancing. But even without getting into Kabbalah, if I'm a Jew now, I can afford to put on a nice Egyptian linen clothing, because now my Jewish identity is now much more safe and secure. I don't have to worry about what it would mean if I dress like an Egyptian, now that I'm being redeemed. I think what it also says is that they weren't greedy, is that you would expect slaves that had so little for so long to all of a sudden make a mad dash for gold and silver and to just express their avaricious desire to now be rich, and now to not just be rich, but take advantage of the Egyptians. And the fact that they preferred the clothing shows there's a certain degree of modesty and willingness to live within means and lack of financial ambition. They're not looking to get rich. They're just looking to take what they need, and they're looking to fulfill HaKadosh Baruch Hu's request that he made of them, that they should daber no b'nei Yisrael, be a shalush m'rayon in the beginning of the parsha. So I think there are three issues that are highlighted by the clothing. Number one, the transition into free men from naked slaves. Number two, the budding confidence in the Jewish identity that could allow them to wear Egyptian clothing after 200 years of demanding specifically Jewish clothing, which are presumably inferior, whatever clothing they were able to wear, whenever times they were able to wear them. And then finally, on the fact that they're not avaricious. They're not letting their base traits come through. And I think that's on display in the conclusion of the Rashi, where Rashi says, Vayishalom, a strange language, Vayashilom. It should have said Vayishalom, and the Torah writes Vayashilom. So Rashi says that essentially the Egyptians were very, very generous. The Jews asked for one bar of gold, the Egyptians to take two. And the Jews asked for one bar of silver, the Egyptians to take two. And the Jews asked for a few articles of clothing to take my whole wardrobe. And it highlights not just the generosity of the Egyptians, but the whole question why they had to ask. I mean, they deserved it. They should just take 210 years of slave labor. They deserve whatever gold and silver they can squirrel away in their pockets. The answer is Hashem is avoiding aggressiveness and bellicose behavior. And sometimes when your people have been victimized for so long, there's a lot of anger and violence, that there's a backlash and there's an outburst of anger and violence. So it would have been completely, completely legitimate for the Jews to just walk into the Egyptians' home. We have the upper hand now, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is on our side, and grab what they want. But they're asking. And part of the asking is, of course, to serve as a catharsis for the Egyptians. The Egyptians, those who were semi-pious and semi-moral, probably had a lot of guilt on their hearts about all the years of persecution. So this is a catharsis for them, but at least we're paying, and that's why they want to be generous. They want to offer more than the Jews are asking. Obviously, the Egyptians' favorable view of the Jews is important theologically. They're starting to realize that HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the Jews, just like in Purim, Rabbi Me'aretz Messiah Hadim, that a lot of the people weren't becoming Jews. They were just looking at the Jews more favorably and getting closer to monotheism as opposed to the paganism of Persia, the pagan worship of the Persians. So I think the whole scene is a scene of people not expressing their base desires, not making themselves greedy, not expressing violence towards their former taskmasters, asking, and of course the Egyptians reinforcing that sense that you deserve it by giving more. And the clothing is just highlighting the fact that we're not interested in greed and wealth, which may have to be held up to Rashi and Parshas B'Shalach, and Moshe had to drag the people away from the Yamsuf, because at least at that point they became a little bit too entrenched and enchanted with wealth. And they were somehow the power of gold became a little bit too persuasive in their minds after the second round. But at least in Mitzrayim, the portrait of the Jews is a people who aren't greedy but prefer clothing. So three different Rashis. One Rashi about the Etzem Hayom Hazeh, the precision of Hashgacha Pratis, but also the cyclical nature of history. The history occurs in the same place and on the same date, and of course, more importantly, the same patterns. And therefore, we have to look back to history, and it's not open-ended but cyclical, and there's a clear terminus rather than an open-ended progressiveness. Number one. Number two, the fact that, what did we talk about number two? Seyed al-Aderech, the fact that we didn't take food beyond the lack of the baking of the matzah, demonstrated our love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though it wasn't such a major decision in the grand scheme of things, it was a gesture. And that gesture is amplified and magnified in Sefer Yirmiyah, as if we eloped with Hashem, we didn't do anything, we were b'chipazon. But the gesture is important in a relationship. And number three is the clothing being more beloved to them, A, because they couldn't wear, B, because they didn't wear Egyptian clothing a few times that they did wear, but C, because it wasn't greed and hostility and aggression. It was more just creating a cathartic experience for the Egyptians and receiving their legitimate wages for 210 years. Shabbat shalom. Welcome back to Yale.